It's my great pleasure and deep honor to introduce Secretary Norman Mineta, retired Secretary of Transportation for the U.S. Department of Transportation, and perhaps most importantly, also the founder of the Mineta Transportation Institute. We're so pleased you could join us. Though Secretary Mineta likely doesn't need a formal introduction, it's always my pleasure to share a few key highlights. He started his political career first as a San Jose City Council member, before moving on to serve as mayor, and then serving for over 20 years in Congress. He then became one of the only people in our nation's history to serve in two presidential administrations, first as the Secretary of Commerce for President Clinton, then as the Secretary of Transportation for President Bush. He's perhaps most well known for his decisive actions on the day of 9/11, when he made the decision to ground all air traffic over the United States and to work with Canada to divert international air traffic to Canadian airports. We thank him for his actions at that time. We thank him for his tireless support of surface transportation, aviation, infrastructure, and security, and we're so pleased he could be with us today. Thank you.
Karen, thank you for that very wonderful, generous introduction. I thought when you said retarded, I thought, no, that means retired, not retarded. I'm really, it's a pleasure for me to have this opportunity to be here at the Commonwealth Club to chair the radio portion of today's program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of our past programs. Now, today's program is being sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute, and our topic today impacts every American, funding America's transportation infrastructure. Congress says that Americans won't pay more taxes and fees for one of the freedoms that they cherish, mobility. Now, is that really true? What exactly are the funding challenges, and how are transportation leaders addressing them? Today, to address this subject and its related issues, we are really pleased to present to you Secretary Brian Kelly, Secretary of the California State Transportation Agency. Now, let me say a bit about Secretary Kelly. First of all, Secretary Kelly is the first Secretary of the California State Transportation Agency, which replaced the Business, Transportation, and Housing Agency. And this new agency is focused primarily and only on transportation. Now, prior to him becoming the Secretary of the Cal State Transportation Agency, he had run the Business, Transportation, and Housing Agency since March of 2012, when Governor Brown appointed him to lead that agency. And as secretary of that agency, as acting secretary, he oversaw 12 departments, along with economic development and commissions that are with more than 45,000 employees and some $18 billion budget. And that's a budget that probably exceeds that of a lot of states. So at this time, let's welcome Secretary Kelly to the podium and have you start your presentation.
Well, good morning. A little housekeeping here. Good morning, and thank you, Secretary Mineta, for the kind introduction. And I want to say what an honor it is to share a stage with you, and appreciate very much your service to the country and to the state of California. So thank you very much. My name is Brian Kelly, and I'm the Secretary for the Transportation Agency in the state of California. I want to welcome everybody to the 2016 Norman Mineta Policy Summit on Transportation Finance. It's, as I said, a real honor for me to be here with all of you this morning, and I want to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute and the Commonwealth Club for hosting this important event and really this critical conversation that is an ongoing conversation in Sacramento about transportation finance in California. Before I get too far into my prepared remarks, I would like to recognize the panelists who will be participating in today's forum as well, following my comments and our Q&A. First, while I don't see him yet in the audience, I believe he's proposed to be on the panel, and that's my friend Steve Heminger, the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Of course, Grace Gruniken from the General Manager of BART here in the Bay Area. Tim Rainey, who I also haven't seen yet this morning, but Tim is an old friend of mine who is now heading up the California Workforce Development Board, and Dr. Asha Agrawal, Director of the Mineta Institute's National Transportation Finance Center, and of course, Dr. Karen Philbreck, the Executive Director of the Institute. I also want to recognize a very important person in this audience, and that is my wife, Laura Kelly. We have three. Thank you. We have three kids that keep us both very busy. So I got to say that this is a rare and welcome opportunity to have her join me here today. I want to thank all of you for being here this morning. As I said, I welcome the opportunity to spend a few moments with you to discuss transportation funding and policy. And as I mentioned, this is an ongoing conversation we are working through in Sacramento. And while we have not yet arrived at a comprehensive funding package that can garner the necessary two-thirds vote of the legislature for passage, the Brown administration remains committed to achieving something that has eluded policymakers in California for decades, really, and that is stabilizing our transportation funding in California. Not just for today, but for the long term, for years to come. In a few moments, I'm going to return to the specifics of the Brown administration's funding plan. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about the challenges we face in transportation in California today and into the future, as well as the opportunities we have to meet those difficult challenges. First, I would say that one should not underestimate the impact of climate change on transportation policy in California. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions has become the leading strategy to combat the effects of climate change. And in California, it's estimated that roughly 40% of greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector, and the vast majority of those from automobiles and truck emissions. The legislature, beginning back in 2006, passed AB 32, known as the Global Warming Solutions Act. And 2 years later, it passed SB 375, which was a regional transportation planning reform bill. Both of those bills worked together to do two things in the law. One was to cap the emissions of GHG in the state of California, and the second one was to ask regional transportation planning agencies to really take the lead in planning for more efficient land use, preservation of agricultural land, steps to bring housing closer to job centers, reducing vehicle miles traveled, and of course, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In 2015, Governor Brown then issued an executive order that tightened the cap on greenhouse gases even further, reducing emissions by 40% below the 1990 levels by 2030, and 80% below those levels by 2050. The point, of course, in making this history is to just make clear that in California, reducing greenhouse gas emissions is not simply a matter of want or limited to actions of this administration. It is a matter of law and policy. And when this administration goes, I think the challenges in transportation to meet the broader challenge of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change will certainly remain. Since 40% of GHG emissions come from our sector, our job today is quite clear. promote transportation policies that address not just the state's mobility and safety objectives, but also our sustainability and environmental objectives. Now, the good news, from my perspective anyway, is that there is a sort of alignment of the stars occurring in which consumers of transportation services, no doubt tired of sitting on congested highways, are demanding more and varied transportation options. They're demanding these increased options at the same time the state is pursuing cleaner alternatives for travel. Technology is advancing to provide those alternatives. Policymakers are more willing than ever to experiment with new concepts to improve mobility. And there's a broad and growing sense that long-term funding for transportation must be stabilized. In short, the planets may be aligning, at least enough, to provide opportunity to address our many transportation challenges. Now, it's no longer enough to simply invest in transportation to improve mobility alone. Investments today must achieve more: improved mobility, greater transportation choices, reduced vehicle miles traveled, reduced congestion, improved safety, and, as I mentioned, as a matter of law, reduced greenhouse gases and other harmful emissions. The Brown administration has adopted a transportation policy perspective that reflects these broader goals. We are incorporating concepts like innovation, experimentation, and, as I noted and will note later, funding stabilization to improve transportation in California. I want to provide you some examples of what I mean in each of these areas. Again, innovation, experimentation, and funding stabilization. First, in the area of innovation, I got to say that in my career of working in transportation policy, which is now about 21 years, I have never felt the palpable impact of technology in this sector like I do today. The emergence of technology is changing the way people get around through ride-sharing services offered by Lyft or Uber and others. Technology is changing the way we buy and sell vehicles, increasingly utilizing the internet to conduct transactions as opposed to brick-and-mortar dealerships. Smartphones, owned by more than 90% of the population, are providing real-time data to consumers on travel conditions, transit schedules, and travel options that affect how they move. Companies like Tesla, Nissan, Ford, and Chevy are advancing zero-emission vehicles and battery technology to broaden accessibility to the electric vehicle ownership, and the promise of autonomous vehicles to provide greater access to mobility and improve safety is set to be unleashed later this year. Many of these trends hold promise to establish a transportation future that is cleaner, more efficient, and safer. And I want to talk about three areas under the category of innovation in which I think the Brown administration has led. Some, I will say, are not without controversy. The first is a little project called high-speed rail. Now, again, I've been messing around in transportation policy for 21 years, and I can't think of a single project that will transform how we travel throughout this state more than high-speed rail. Consider these numbers. A passenger rail trip today between Southern California and the Bay Area is offered once a day and takes about 12 hours to complete. There's an alternative rail option, and that requires a bus ride from Los Angeles to Bakersfield, a transfer to a train in Bakersfield to complete your journey to Oakland in about 8.5 hours. Now, in November of 2013, I was fortunate enough to travel on high-speed rail between Madrid and Barcelona, Spain. We covered approximately 385 miles, nearly the distance between San Francisco and Los Angeles, in 2 hours and 25 minutes. Today, commuting between cities like Merced to San Jose might take between 2.5 or 3 hours, some days longer. High-speed rail will offer commuters that trip in 43 minutes. That is the promise of high-speed rail. And because of that promise, I'm confident Californians and those visiting California will use the system. The mobility and convenience benefits are obvious, and so are the environmental benefits. In country after country that has established high-speed rail, be it France, Spain, Japan, China, etc., the option to take high-speed rail between two destination cities has resulted in fewer vehicle trips and fewer airplane trips between those cities in favor of efficient high-speed rail trips. That kind of mode shift has considerable benefits when it comes to reducing GHG and other vehicular emissions. We expect to see the same in California when the project is operational between Northern and Southern California. Second area under the category of innovation where I think the governor has led quite a bit is in the area of zero emission vehicle technology. Governor Brown has embraced clean vehicle technology as a major part of an overall climate strategy to reduce fuel consumption and reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California. In 2012, the governor signed an executive order directing state agencies to accelerate the market of ZEVs in California with the goal of having 1.5 million ZEV vehicles on California's roads by 2025. Since the order, the administration has worked with the legislature to provide incentives to expand ZEV ownership and to expand necessary infrastructure needed for ZEV operations in the state. Plug-in electric vehicle ownership in California has passed 200,000 vehicles, meaning that Californians drive 45% of the ZEVs on the road in the United States, 45% in California. Once again, the state is leading the nation when it comes to vehicle innovation. Soon, a state interagency working group will release the 2016 ZEV action plan that will outline additional actions various agencies will take to further the ZEV market in California. Third, under the category of innovation, is autonomous vehicles. The next step in vehicle innovation is, of course, the emergence of this technology, autonomous, or more commonly known as driverless vehicles. Autonomous vehicle technology has various levels of sophistication, some of which you see in vehicles on the road today, things like brake assist, anti-lane departure, self-parking technology. These technologies are increasingly included in late model vehicles made available now. The question many are asking is, when will we see vehicles that are truly driverless, some even without steering wheels? I'm not sure anybody really knows the answer to that question, but I am sure the technology holds promise to increase safety and increase access to mobility for those who cannot drive. For example, by 2045, the number of Americans over the age of 65 will increase by 81%. About one-third of people over 65 have a disability that limits their mobility. Autonomous vehicles could expand important access to mobility for these and other Americans who cannot or do not drive today. Under state legislation passed in 2013, the Department of Motor Vehicles, a department under my agency, is tasked with developing regulations for the testing and deployment of these vehicles in California. The testing regulations are actually done. And today, 14 vehicle manufacturers are testing about 111 vehicles on California's roadways. I want to assure you, these vehicles have both steering wheels and drivers behind them. The next step is to develop regulations for autonomous vehicles to be fully deployed in California. And as you can imagine, the state and my Department of Motor Vehicles has been very careful with these regulations, wanting to ensure public safety is the highest and first priority. After publicly releasing a draft regulation at the end of 2015, I'm happy to report that the California DMV is now working very closely, hand in glove, I would say, with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, to develop the right regulatory framework for manufacturers to develop, test, and perhaps ultimately deploy autonomous vehicle technology safely in the state and broadly in the country. In fact, I'll be in Washington, D.C. next week speaking with NHTSA about this very issue. I'm anticipating both NHTSA and the California DMV will move forward with guidelines and regulations later this summer. These advances in technology, of course, allow us to also engage in a little bit more experimentation with transportation, and I think now is certainly a time to do that. And under this heading, there's areas where this administration has outlined places to experiment, and I want to talk a little bit about that. As many of you know, for more than 30 years, California's major urban areas, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, San Diego, and the Inland Empire, have occupied the list of the nation's most congested places. While local, state, and federal governments have poured billions of dollars into improving our roads and freeways to accommodate growth, congestion remains as vexing a problem in California today as it ever has. Perhaps it's time for another way to combat this problem. Data tells us that congestion cannot be solved in any lasting way by simply adding more lanes of highway. Such a strategy is not enough. It must be coupled with new approaches that look less at specific projects and more at improving corridors, that look less at analyzing how many cars we can squeeze through a segment of highway, and instead look at how we can reliably move people to their destinations. Highway and road investment alone will neither solve our congestion problems nor provide the mobility options that Californians want and are seeking. That said, Californians do continue to drive, and they drive a lot, more than any other state. Therefore, as we move forward toward meeting emission reductions, we cannot ignore the condition and operations of our highways, roads, and bridges. They require investment today, and they will certainly require investment into the future. We simply must be smarter in how we invest in roadway expansion, and I for one, am for less of a project-by-project approach to meet our mobility needs and more of a corridor-wide approach. Toward that end, in 2014, Governor Brown signed legislation AB 194 that made it easier for both regions and localities and the state to get approval for projects that include pricing or tolling as a project element. Now, I acknowledge that tolling is not wildly popular, and I would say on this subject I'm a bit of a convert myself, but I would say that price lanes do provide a way to pay for corridor improvements, pay for long-term life cycle costs of a project, including long-term maintenance and rehabilitation, encourage carpooling, and fund mobility options within crowded corridors like bus rapid transit or parallel rail service. This approach has the benefit of encouraging project sponsors to analyze a broader suite of strategies to improve mobility in key corridors. It has been utilized on State Route 91 in Riverside County, on the I-405 in Orange County, and is under discussion more locally here on Highway 101 in Silicon Valley. Just as we have opened the door to experiment with expanded pricing to address congested corridors, we must experiment with new options to fund our broader transportation system. I mentioned earlier that this administration has been a leader in pushing policies to expand the market for electric vehicles in California. And that policy is the right policy for our environment and for public health. However, it does present challenges for funding improvements to our transportation infrastructure. For the first time in my career, revenues from our gasoline excise tax are on a declining projection over the next couple of decades. Improved automobile efficiency and, of course, inflation combined to erode the value of the gas tax over time. As we consume less gasoline during the transition to cleaner vehicle fleet, gasoline tax revenues, what some have called the mother's milk of transportation funding, declines. And so we must explore other options to fund our immense and complex transportation system. On July 1st, in just about 2 weeks, Caltrans will begin experimenting with another option, a vehicle miles traveled fee we simply call the road charge. Pursuant to legislation signed by Governor Brown in 2014, the department will commence a statewide pilot project to assess the viability, the public acceptance, the administrative ease, and potential revenue generation from a fee paid based not on how much gasoline you purchase, but on how many miles you drive. The pilot project will rely on 5,000 volunteers experimenting with different methods to track not where they travel, but how far. While no actual fees will be charged during the pilot, Caltrans will learn how such a fee can be administered, how much money it can generate, and really gauge the volunteer acceptance of the program. After the 9-month pilot program, the department will review the data and prepare a report for the legislature's consideration in 2017. I'm eager to both participate in the pilot. I did sign up to be a volunteer. And I'm looking forward to seeing its results next year. So while we rely on innovation to provide new mobility options that help us achieve broad policy objectives, and we experiment with new concepts, to help us achieve new concepts, to help us meet tough challenges. What is it that is always the primary challenge when it comes to transportation policy in California? Anyone? Anyone? Funding. Thank you, Rod. Funding. Last year on this score, Governor Brown submitted to the legislature a 10-year, $37 billion funding package to invest in fixing our highways and neighborhood streets, improving the state's trade corridors, and improving public transit. The package represented a near doubling of the last 10-year transportation funding package approved by the legislature. Governor Brown's proposal is a balance of new dedicated revenue to improve California's transportation system and reasonable reform and accountability measures to maximize efficiency from those investments. The proposal reflects the following core principles. One, focus on fix-it-first priorities to target new revenues on the acute state and local deferred maintenance problem in California. No California driver is driving on our highways and local streets and not experiencing the unfortunate condition of our roadways. We rank about 45th in the country in current highway condition, and we need to do much better. Two, we need to make investments in targeted areas to ensure California's long-term competitiveness, like the state's important trade corridors. Three, continue the state-local partnership to fund improvements important to both the state and local governments. Four, adopt specific performance measures and reporting requirements so policymakers and the public know exactly what investments will achieve and administrative agencies are held accountable for performance. And six or five, ensure new transportation revenues are dedicated solely to transportation purposes. The revenue under the governor's plan is raised through the following actions. One, we would set an annual road improvement charge that every vehicle owner would pay of $65 on all vehicles registered in California. We would end what is now an annual adjustment to the gasoline tax, excise tax, and set that tax at a five-year average and then index it to inflation so that it grows with costs. We would raise the excise tax on diesel fuel by 11 cents. We would dedicate more cap and trade revenue to public transit and a low-carbon neighborhood street program, and expediting the repayment of outstanding loans made from transportation accounts in the past that are not due to be repaid until the early 2020s. And finally, funding generated by the road improvement charge and the gasoline and excise diesel tax changes would be constitutionally dedicated to transportation purposes under our plan. Now, again, it raises $37 billion over 10 years, and that sounds like an awful lot, and that sounds like an awful lot of taxes. But we have the Department of Finance estimate what it would mean to the average motorist in California. And it comes down to the average motorist paying about $85 per year, which translates into $7 a month, or about 25 cents a day. When I hear those numbers, I'm reminded of Ronald Reagan's quote, when he signed legislation to raise the federal gas tax in 1983, he said, "The cost to the average motorist will be small, but the benefit to our transportation system will be immense." Our proposal dedicates the new transportation revenue to the following purposes: 50% for state infrastructure priorities and 50% for local priorities. State revenue would be dedicated to maintaining, rehabilitating our state highways and bridges, and for investment in the state's trade corridors. We also would provide new money for public transit. Local share funding would be available to local governments for improvements to city and county roads, for public transit grants, and to continue the state-local partnership program. So the administration's proposal also includes some important and reasonable reforms and accountability provisions. I'll touch on a couple of those. One, we would include specific performance measures and reporting requirements for Caltrans to inform the CTC, the legislature, and the public on its work toward improving the condition of our state-owned assets. The 10-year extension of a public-private partnership authority to utilize innovative financing to deliver infrastructure projects. We would expand innovative procurement authority for Caltrans to deliver projects faster. We'd increase staffing flexibility so Caltrans can use the right mix of state and consultant staff to deliver increased workload. And we would streamline the environmental review process that includes a limited CEQA exemption for repair and rehabilitation projects within the existing right-of-way. We'd expand use of a concept called advanced mitigation, like that pioneered in Orange County, so Caltrans can work with natural resources partners to identify the most meaningful mitigation strategies early in the project delivery process and reduce late conflicts and challenges. And also, we would continue practice that we use in California today that is subject to sunset, which is using a combined federal-state process called NEPA and CEQA to work both those processes simultaneously through the environmental clearance phase. And as I mentioned, we have a constitutional amendment to dedicate transportation revenue to transportation purposes. So in sum, the administration's proposal includes needed revenue and reasonable reform, crafted to bridge differences we observed between Democrats and Republicans and their proposals, and to comprehensively and efficiently invest to improve California's transportation system. Now, as you can all imagine, it has been difficult to get legislative traction on a $37 billion tax proposal in an election year. We have bounced between the budget process and an ongoing special session on transportation. And as I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, the necessary two-thirds vote to approve a comprehensive funding package has remained elusive. That said, the Brown administration remains steadfast in our desire to stabilize transportation funding in California over the long term. Remember, the legislature has not acted to increase the gas tax in 26 years. Since 2012, 22 other states, led by Democrats and Republicans, have acted to increase transportation funding, and all sides appear to agree on the need. So with the transportation special session still open, I remain hopeful we can work with the leaders of the legislature to get this done. And as the governor said last January, while we may not know exactly when, the roads must get fixed. While I hold out hope the stars will align, I am mindful of that William Shakespeare quote, "It is not in the stars to hold our destiny, but in ourselves." Thank you very much.
Well, our thanks to Secretary Kelly for your fine presentation. So now it's time for our audience to deal with our question and answer period. And I have a number of cards here that have been submitted. So let's begin with these cards. And, Brian, I'm going to sort of take some of these and at least read them out loud to you. And then if you could incorporate your answer with these questions in mind. There's a gap between the state's transportation resources and its needs. If we are unsuccessful in achieving increased revenues, what alternatives will you and the Brown administration pursue to deliver to address this gap? What are the current prospects of extending SB4 and enabling public-private partnerships like the Presidio Parkway? What, if anything, is the California State Transportation Agency doing to discourage local or regional jurisdictions from embarking on road widening projects at the expense of the corridor approach that you seem to be espousing? And how important is the traditional user pay concept? Can it be sustained in an environment of multimodal transportation systems?
I have to answer all of them. No, just kidding.
I'm going to do the best I can to answer those. I'm not sure if I got them all, so I'm going to have to work with you on some of the cards. First, the question about what we're doing to discourage road widening projects. I think it is maybe a philosophical, or I would even argue a practical view, that we cannot achieve the objectives that I outlined in terms of our transportation investments by only relying on road widening projects to try to achieve our mobility gains. And I think what we are doing is driving the conversation away from that approach. And I pointed to legislation we passed that included pricing element. But I want to say that pricing element is not so much about just building new roads. The pricing element to me on a hot lane that is tied to a carpooling incentive has other benefits about paying for the entirety of any new project, both on the front end and the rehabilitation and maintenance over time. And more importantly, as we've seen in some of the places where those have been implemented, it also enables the ability to fund other strategies, including transit, rail, or bus systems through that same area, and even improvements to local bike and pedestrian facilities. So I would say that our agency is espousing getting away from the traditional means of trying to address mobility challenges strictly with new lanes and moving toward a more comprehensive and varied strategy. I'd also say that we are, you know, working very closely with local governments. In fact, under our leadership, Caltrans has changed much of its design guidance, now enacting or incorporating national guidance on how local streets and roads can be designed that really facilitate opening up the roads to different modes, not just cars, but working to assure that all users are safe, including transit riders, bicyclists, and pedestrians. And that really took a change at the department that we continue to work through, but I think we've made gains with locals. There's another question about the prospects for the public-private partnerships, and as I mentioned, at least in the legislation that the governor's office has proposed, we would propose to extend the authority for public-private partnerships, which is set to sunset next year by its own by its own language. I want to say this about P3s, though. They do not represent, in my view, you know, some new infusion of money that comes from the private sector and the state is off the hook, or the public sector is off the hook. That's not how they work. It does provide opportunity for equity to come in and relieve some pressure on public money in the short term. You could see in those some risk transfer on project development, where incentives are built in so the private sector takes on more risk than the public sector. But whether or not you use a true P3 on a project is really a project-by-project review and analysis, and not something I would articulate for every transportation project in California. I would also say that I believe everything we do at some level is a P3. I would remind everybody that when you build a new road or lane in California, it's not like the Caltrans is the folks out there building it alone. They often help with the design of the project, but we contract with private partners to construct those facilities. So almost everything we do involves a partnership with the private sector. So I'm for keeping P3s in the toolbox as an option to deliver transportation projects. But I really think it's important that approach, that they prove themselves as efficient, that you see the risk transfer that they promise. And so those elements are important. But I'd also say that the expansion of pricing and tolling will probably lead to more proposals to do P3-type projects. I've missed a couple.
Mr. Secretary, let me combine the next three cards also. It's not only the level of transportation funding that matters, but also its structure and influence on planning. What is your assessment of the dominance of county-controlled funding, SB 45 and self-help, above state and regionally controlled funding? If revision is warranted, what is your policy and the political agenda attached to it? And what do the changes in technology you see mean for our ability to collect revenues to pay for the infrastructure? Road fees collected automatically by phone, VMT. How do we speed up planning and construction and funding of major transportation projects like passenger rail electrification and the second Transbay tunnel for BART high-speed rail Caltrain?
Okay.
Next question.
I will get to each of those three. I did recall one of the other ones was what actions would you take if you can't close the funding gap between state resources and needs. And I guess I would answer it by saying we would continue to do some of the things we do today, which is try to get as much as we can out of the resources we have, and that requires smarter ways to deliver projects. For example, we are for and are encouraging the Department of Transportation to be allowed to use a variety of procurement methods, not just your standard design, bid, build method, but a variety of procurement methods to try to speed up design of projects and speed up the relationship between the designer and the contractor, or make it a closer relationship earlier in the project, so that you have the potential to speed up some time. And so we will continue to work to be more efficient. We'll continue to bring the best materials available to projects, and we will take all the actions that we try to take to deliver projects as efficiently as possible. But there's no getting around the funding issue. And look, I say that as somebody who is not a fan of the way we articulate needs for transportation today. The last major statewide needs assessment that was done said over 10 years we need $300 billion. That's a survey-based needs assessment. And one, we're not ever going to get $300 billion out of the legislature over a course of 10 years, one. Two, those kinds of assessments tend to include not just needs but wants. And we can't do what everybody wants. I think the way we have to approach this, and I would say the way that the Brown administration has approached our funding proposal, is to try to identify what we want to accomplish over the next 10 years or so, and even longer, and then line up revenue or funding to allow us to accomplish that. And that has been our approach to date, and I think that's the only way to figure out a long-term funding plan, because I think inherent in getting those kinds of plans passed by in the political process and passed by the public at large, or approved by the public at large, they have to understand what they're getting for the investment. So I think that's an important approach. So to the questions, what are some options for speeding up the approval of projects? As I mentioned, there are some things we do now that we should continue to do. California is one of only a handful of states that has delegated the authority to combine the federal and state environmental review process in a more singular process, and that helps a bit. I think we can always do better on communication at the state between different agencies and departments in discussing and getting permit approval for projects. Sometimes we are too siloed, and those conversations happening earlier on big projects are important. I think we're seeing some of that progress on the beginning of the construction of high-speed rail, but I think earlier conversations between agencies and departments is important to get permit approval more efficient. We are seeking to do more general efficiency proposals, both through the environmental process and the procurement process, to try to speed up the delivery of projects in California. Question about technology changes to improve infrastructure and what kind of challenges those present for funding. I mentioned in my comment that, you know, we are for innovation in vehicle technology. We are for moving to a cleaner system. But that does have an impact on the revenue we've traditionally used for transportation funding. And so we are looking, we have to look at other ways. We have to look beyond the gas tax, for example, to fund transportation. And I think there's a whole slew of, funding options that may, come online affecting, transportation network companies, TNCs, and others as they grow and emerge in the transportation sector, that may be wholly new ways we're funding transportation that none of us have thought about before. So I don't know what all the options are. What I do know is that technology changes are affecting how we fund transportation in California today, and that we have to explore several options. I also think that, and this may get to some of the other questions about planning, we have made a conscious decision in California, starting back in the 1990s, that generally the best level of government for transportation planning is probably at the regional level. It takes on, sort of consolidates all the local different dynamics and tries to make sense out of it on a regional basis. And regions, I would argue, might have a better sense of what's required locally to make to accommodate growth and to plan correctly than the state would. And so I'm not an advocate of necessarily pulling that to the state level. I think what I would say is what I said is one of my objectives when I first took this job. You know, I had three objectives when I took this job, and in fact, preparing for this talk, I went back and looked at my response to the Senate Rules Committee during my confirmation. They said, you know, what are your top three objectives in transportation? And I said, they are the following. One, we think it's important to develop high-speed rail in California, so we're on that. You know, two, we think it's important to stabilize transportation funding over the long term, and we're working on that. And three, and importantly, we want to move SB 375 planning documents and planning purposes into the implementation phase. And that means not that the state takes it over, but how do we partner well with regions who are doing these planning exercises to articulate how they will grow in an efficient, smart, and cleaner way. And it's up to the state to figure out how we will partner with them to make that happen. And those are the three objectives that we outlined when I was first confirmed back in 2013. And we are really every day at the agency working on those three areas. And I define those easily to you all because I've made a list for my staff and said, look, any given day in California, when I have seven departments that employ 40,000 people all across the state, all kinds of things are blown in the door every day. And we need to remember the few things that we really need to get done and care about. And we have that list, and many of them, although not all of them, have it posted on their wall. And we have to do that to remind ourselves what we're trying to accomplish. So did I miss anything?
No, that's fine.
Okay. All right.
It's just like having that list that says to your kids, brush your teeth.
It's on my wall, too.
Yeah. The most recent cap-and-trade auction fell drastically short of expectations. What are your insights on this shortfall and thoughts of how the cap-and-trade program might look going forward? And the other question, of course, is the same. It says, what are your thoughts on the future of cap-and-trade revenues?
There is some uncertainty in Sacramento, and I would say there's pending litigation on this question, but there's some uncertainty about what happens with the cap and trade program beyond 2020. In the administration, the department that runs the cap and trade program is the California Air Resources Board, and I think they have a position of some comfort that they can continue to run the program beyond 2020, and they have made that case. It is being challenged in the courts, and the state won a lower court decision. It's now on appeal. But I do think the uncertainty about the future of cap and trade is probably what led to an auction that was lower than people expected in terms of revenues that came in. And I think uncertainty probably has some in the market scratching their heads on exactly what's going to be required then beyond 2020, and therefore how vibrantly or robustly should they be playing in the cap and trade market. So I do think there's some uncertainty there. In terms of the future of it, you may have seen in some recent newspaper articles, but both Governor Brown and the Brown administration are engaged in conversations with the legislature on clarifying some of that uncertainty around the cap and trade program and making more certain that we expect it to be around for some time beyond 2020. I think when that happens, you'll see a stabilization in the auction process, and I think the program will remain functional.
Secretary, what concerns do you have about security and transportation in the current environment, and how is the agency addressing those concerns?
That's a really good question. You know, I think the first time we all got wider eyes on security in the transportation sector was, of course, following the events of 9/11. And it did have an impact on the policy that came out of Sacramento. Back in 2006, when I worked for Senator Parada, we put together a major transportation bond bill known as Proposition 1B that went on the ballot and was supported, thankfully, by a majority of Californians, and allowed us to make some investment in transportation with general obligation bonds. In that sense, it was a one-time sort of investment. But that bond package included things that we had never really talked about before, which was state funding and state assistance strictly for security issues on public transit and at our ports, our seaports and airports and ports of entry along the international border. We had never done that before in terms of a concentrated investment of public money. We still do that, but I would say more of it is probably being provided through the state and the federal government, not through my agency, but through the California Office of Emergency Services that they actually oversaw some of the grant program we had, but they continue to be the filter or the next, the distributor, if you will, of federal funds and other state funds to for port, transit, and other security needs. So we it continues to be a hot topic, and it's, of course, and unfortunately, more important than ever. There are big conversations around security when we build and deliver new assets like the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. You know, without going into detail, I can certainly tell you that there is not a more secure or monitored bridge in the state of California than that one. And you see more and more of this through OES grants for ports in California and transit systems. So we continue to focus on it. Of course, as we develop high-speed rail, we learn a lot about that issue, and we will be incorporating into the development of that program appropriate security measures.
About high-speed rail, isn't it a very expensive solution? And how many people were on that train from Barcelona to Madrid? And what does the future really hold for high-speed rail in California? And when do you think it will be completed?
This is a softball. Let's talk about the train in Spain. That was a eye-opening experience because even for me, high-speed rail, I see the great – I look at the – look, I left the state Senate where I had a fine job, and I left it to work in this administration because I believe that the development of high-speed rail is transformative in California, and I believe – So having the opportunity to help develop a project like that is something I couldn't resist, candidly. So I left the Senate and took this job, and I'm dedicated to trying to get it done. And let me tell you, that, what's that old adage? Nothing worth doing is easy. And this is not easy, okay? There's all kinds of challenges. But let's be clear about a couple. Let me go back to the train in Spain now. eye-opening. Why is it eye-opening? Well, let me tell you a couple of things. First, our train was scheduled to leave the station in Madrid at 8 o'clock a.m., and they have a policy there that if your train leaves more than 5 minutes after its departure time, your ticket's refunded. Guess what time our train left? 8 a.m. 8 a.m., and 2 hours and 25 minutes later, we were in Barcelona. So, you know, there's a great efficiency that they are utilizing on that project. Secondly, every car of that train was full. Every car of that train was full. Now, I think it may have been part of a commute system. I noticed that many of the people on the train had laptops open, and some were in business attire or quasi-business attire. I would also note, while it was 8 a.m., the bar car was full. But it was an eye-opening experience in terms of, man, this is really, really what we're talking about. And look, the numbers to me today are embarrassing. I mean, 12 hours to take a train from the Southern California, it's embarrassing. We think we can do a lot better. And look, in a state where we are trying to do transportation policy programs and projects that are not just about strictly mobility, but mobility, efficiency, environmental stewardship, achieving our climate objectives, there's no for me on that option. So is it expensive? It is expensive. It's estimated at $64 billion to get it done. But I want to talk about that, too, because a lot of folks like to say, particularly the critics, man, we went to the voters on this back in 2008, and we only put up we only asked for $9 billion. And that's true. But even in the voter pamphlet that was placed before the voters, it said this is a $9 billion ask of state money. We're going to try to seek federal money and private money to get it built. But the voter pamphlet says the cost will exceed $45 billion. That was back in 2008. So it's not like we ever got to a place on this project that now we have full funding. It was partially funded from the beginning, and that has been the single greatest challenge of this project. There are other challenges. We spent a lot of time in litigation. But the funding issue is the key issue. But on that score, we've made some pretty important progress. Shortly after the bond was passed, the federal government did the ARRA Act. And the state of California received $3.3 billion toward high-speed rail from that fund. In 2014, the state of California and the legislature said, we want to dedicate cap and trade money to that program going forward because we want to build that system. With the cap and trade allocation, assuming that program is stabilized as we talked about a minute ago, but with the cap and trade program, with the federal grant, and with the state bond money, we know we can build the system at least from the Central Valley to Silicon Valley. And we know that that is an operating segment that that all the projections show will have sufficient ridership so that we don't need an operating subsidy. And that is a great start for the program. And then we have to keep working to find ways how to go south. But the plan is still Bay Area to LA. We got to get going. Our proposal now is take the money we know we should have under the appropriation from the legislature and start building this project and get it done as soon as we can. High-speed rail authority is estimating the valley-to-valley segment will be completed by 2025. And we're on path to do that. So, again, other things are important. The cap and trade program needs to continue to be a funding partner on that. But we're gonna keep going. And next week, again, I'm in Washington, D.C., talking to NHTSA, and I'm going to be talking to the federal government about continuing to be great partners on this project as well. So I feel a little stronger about it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is the Honorable Brian Kelly, Secretary of the California State Transportation Agency, who is discussing how to fund and rebuild both the state and national transportation infrastructure. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. So we're now down to about the last question. But let me interject this real quick one because I'm not really sure what it refers to. Have all 5,000 volunteers been secured for the Road Change pilot project?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. We're going to commence the program on July 1st, and we did various media strategies to get out the word for volunteers. And I think they had a total of something like on the order of 10,000 applicants that originally came in. We could only take five to get the program going. So at least at this point, the department is communicating with folks to let them know that they've been selected. And I guess that could expand if folks ultimately decide not to. But I think the pool, if you will, is set.
Please contrast the MTC's hot lane program with imposing tolls on all lanes. And why are transit systems such as BART not well funded or financed?
Grace? Well, the MTC's Hot Lane program, as I understand it, is a program designed primarily to close gaps that are now in the HOV system down here. So they have a series of HOV lanes, and they are proposing to convert some of those, I think, and close gaps by instituting hot lanes or high occupancy toll lanes to have a more seamless system. And I guess I would say that the difference between having it apply to one or two lanes and not all lanes is in my mind, it then presents some choices for travelers. I think as they are proposing it, they would take some of the toll revenue that would be made available, institute something like a bus rapid transit program to operate on the system. They would encourage, obviously, carpooling on the system, and they would have a pricing element for any single-occupant driver who wanted to access that lane, but it would come with a charge, and I'm sure a charge that would probably be priced based on levels of congestion, as we've seen around the state. So I really kind of think the difference is providing some choice for travelers. Again, I'm a bit of a convert on tolling myself. I hadn't always been the biggest fan of that approach. But as I see what we need to do to meet our vast transportation challenges now, and the idea that you can use that to take a broader corridor approach to mobility and provide options for travelers, I've become more attracted to that idea. So I don't know if that incorporates all of what's in the question. I just know that where I've seen it, I like what hot lanes and pricing can do, and think it's, as I said, at least worth experimenting with. And so I think that's all I'd say about it. I'd also just say, when I talk about what tolling can do in terms of providing options, it's worth reminding everybody in this region that you've got a lot of toll bridges down here, and the revenue from those toll bridges does not just fund those toll bridges. That revenue funds all kinds of transit improvements and ferry boat operations and cross-bay AC transit trips, and so there's a lot that you can get out of that kind of revenue stream, and I'm interested in seeing the utilization of more of that in our more congested corridors around the state. Why is BART not fully funded? Well, you know, BART does pretty well in many respects. BART's got, obviously, challenges with older vehicles, and I know there's a bond measure pending to modernize the system a bit. The state of California has been a partner on funding issues at BART. We never have enough money for all things, but one of the things that I'm doing now is my agency operates a grant program that's made available because we have cap and trade funds. That grant program is made available to transit agencies around the state. Last year, we awarded $225 million to 14 projects around California. This year, our next awards will be in August, and we are poised to award about $400 million, depending on final budget deliberations in Sacramento, but we'll be awarding those as well. BART has been an applicant on some of those funds, is now an applicant on some of those funds, and we are working through the process of looking at all the applications that have come in. But I also would note that, you know, I think BART, and Grace, you'll certainly know this better than I, but BART at one time had a fare box recovery ratio on the order of 67% or something, 75 now, which, you know, for major public transit entities in the country is among the very, very top. So there's no doubt. I mean, I think what my view, and Grace can correct me or frown at me or whatever, my view is that what BART has now is a capacity a problem, great demand. But that also that sort of says, hey, there's great demand, and now we gotta deal with that. And, you know, there's probably going to be an option to do some expansion of the service in the South Bay later in November. It's a project that State of California is keeping a close eye on. And as we go forward and consider things like whether there'd be another train or tube under the bay, that certainly the state will be a partner on that. And I can't imagine a project of that magnitude not getting done without a full partnership from the state of California.
Well, our thanks to the Honorable Brian Kelly, Secretary of the California State Transportation Agency. Now, this program has been sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute. Thank you to our audience here in the room as well as on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone in this room that following the conclusion of this portion of the program, our panel discussion will take place following a five-minute pause to reset the stage. Again, thanks to you, Secretary Kelly, for an excellent presentation. I'm Norm Mineta, former U.S. Secretary of Transportation, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.